The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated.
The court is called to order. As part of Project Outreach, we are hearing oral argument today at the George Washington University Law School. The court calls the case of United States versus Airman First Class Jonathan D. Painter, number ACM 39646. In today's oral argument, we consider, did the military judge abuse his discretion when he denied the appellant's motion to suppress the contents of his cellular phone and the derivative evidence thereof? Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Senior Judge Meek.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Senior Judge Meek, and may it please the court. My name is Major Yolanda Miller, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Gruber, we represent the appellant, Airman First Class Jonathan D. Painter. This court should find that the military judge abused his discretion in determining that the government would have inevitably discovered the photos and the video evidence because the government failed to prove four essential facts. One, that OSI would have sent the phone to DC-3. Two, that DC-3, which is formerly known as DCFL, would have inevitably accessed the phone. Three, that they would have inevitably accessed the Hide It Pro app where the photographs were contained. And then four, that they would have been able to decrypt the video. I will take each point in turn and discuss more in particular how the government failed to prove those factors. With regards to the first factor, that OSI would have sent the phone to DC-3. In his ruling, the military judge adopted the proposed findings of fact that the government put forward in their motion. He adopted them in total, word for word. And in doing so, the military judge ignored the inconsistent testimony provided by Special Agent JJ, as well as the fact that she was not the individual to determine where the phone was sent and when. Specifically, with regards to her inconsistent statements, she testified that she did not tell Airman Painter to unlock his phone. She testified that she did not tell him to permanently disable the passcodes on his phone. She testified that she was the one to permanently disable his phone and remove the passcodes. And she also testified that she never saw his screen, that she could see him punching in numbers but could never see his screen. But in paragraph 4 of the proposed findings of fact that the military judge adopted, it reads that she did tell Airman Painter to input his passcode and that he needed to take off his passcodes permanently. It also reads that both agents in the room looked at his phone and watched him as he entered his passcode and disabled the security features. So again, her testimony clearly conflicts with the findings of fact as found by the military judge. Additionally, she also provided inconsistent statements when it came to the information that she provided to DC-3 before they did their analysis.
Major Miller, before you get to DC-3, which you know, the Defense Computer Forensics Lab, for those that are in the audience, I want to talk about one of the findings of fact that the judge did adopt from the government's motion, and it's in paragraph 8 of the government's motion. But it basically says that if the phone was locked and the BCMO, the Bossier City Marshal's office, was unable to bypass the security code, then the phone would have gone to DC-3. Can you address what's in the record regarding the Bossier City Marshal's office ability to unlock the phone and how that plays into whether the phone even would have gone to DC3 using the normal procedures of the law enforcement agency.
Yes, Your Honor. In the record, Special Agent JJ actually testified that the superintendent of the Barksdale Detachment had a relationship with BCMO, which is the Barksdale County Marshal's Office, and that he knew them to have the same capabilities as DC3, which was DCFL at that time. And so that is why the superintendent actually told her to send the phone to BCMO when there was a backlog at DC3. So there is evidence in the record that BCMO had the same capabilities as DC3 and that they had a prior relationship where they worked together as well.
So would BCMO have been able to unlock the phone and access it just like DC3 because they have the same capabilities?
There is no evidence that they would have been able to unlock the phone, because when the phone was sent to them, it was sent unlocked, and there was no question as to whether or not they could unlock it if the passcodes were put in place. And when BCMO analyzed the phone, they were analyzing it closer in time to when the illegal conduct occurred than DC3 was as well.
Thank you, Major Miller.
So the importance of the inconsistencies is that when analyzing whether or not Special Agent JJ was 100% or 1,000% certain that she would have sent this phone to DC3, her credibility as a witness and her inconsistencies or her flat-out lies, however they're characterized, is very crucial. And the military judge did not make a determination with respect to that because he simply adopted the government's proposed findings of fact. Even assuming arguendo that her credibility was not at issue and she was 100% certain that she would have sent the phone to DC3, it's important that that was not her decision to make. When she testified at page 35 in the electronic record, she said even though she was the case agent, it was not her decision as to where the phone went. That was leadership's decision, hence the superintendent. So even if she was 100% certain, that is irrelevant to whether or not that phone would have inevitably been sent to DC3, because she is not the one that actually makes that decision. Furthermore, as documented by this court in Mancini and Hunt, inevitable discovery requires more than conjecture and speculation. Actually, at page 17 of Mancini, this court stated that the prosecution must prove through demonstrated historical facts that the illegal conduct would have, that the information would have been found despite the illegal conduct. And here saying I am 100% certain that I would send it to DC3 is mere conjecture and speculation. There are no historical demonstrated facts in that statement. And therefore, the military judge abused his discretion in finding that that phone would have been inevitably sent to DC3.
Major Miller, was there any information in the record that established that the OSI detachment's normal investigative procedures was to send the phone to DCFL?
There is nothing in the record as to that. Special Agent JJ did say as a normal course, what she would do is to send it to DC3. However, she also testified that she was new to Barksdale and that she had never worked with BCMO before. So she was new to that detachment and there was no evidence as to what that detachment normally does.
Thank you.
Which brings me to the second factor that the government failed to prove. Even assuming that Special Agent JJ's 100% certainty was proven and that that's sufficient for inevitable discovery, the government did not show that DC3 would have been able to access the phone with his passcodes enabled, vice disabled. And this is specifically referencing the findings of fact that the military judge made in paragraphs 10 through 12. Yes, Mr. TH stated that they would have been able to open the phone using the Cellebrite Universal Forensic Extraction Device. But that's not all he said. He qualified his certainty, and the military judge's findings of fact ignore the qualification. Specifically, He testified that tools that are used, like Cellebrite, for example, have to be constantly updated to keep up with the patches and the vulnerabilities the cell phone companies, you know, I guess, come out with. And he said, he testified at page 92 of the record, the electronic record, that not always do tools get updated to keep up with new technology. And even if the tool was updated, he also testified that his certainty depends on whether or not Airman Painter's phone had the updated, I guess, operating system that would have surpassed the vulnerability the Cellebrite would have exploited. What that means, and he did not testify as to the operating system on Airman Painter's phone. That was not brought up. He did not testify as to whether or not there were any vulnerabilities in the Cellebrite program. So what he said is, as of June 2016, Cellebrite could have got into appellant's phone. But then from June to September, he did not testify as to whether or not new operating systems came out to, I guess, bypass that vulnerability, or whether Cellebrite had been consistently updated. To further qualify his 100% certainty that the military judge did not acknowledge, is he testified that he cannot guarantee that he would have been assigned to the case. And he is one of the most, actually, he is the most, or was the most experienced analyst at DC-3 at the time. The only thing he could say is that another analyst working together should have come to the same result. And that's at page 91 in the record. He also said that there's an interpretive human element to analyzing a cell phone. The forensics are all the same, but at page 94 of the record, he said two different people analyzing a computer could analyze it and not find the same thing. So he's recognizing and he's qualifying his certainty by these qualifications that the military judge did not acknowledge in his findings of fact.
Major Miller, when Mr. TH testified, as you stated, that he would be able to access everything on the phone, does that include the ability to play the video?
No, Your Honor. When he said, because he later testifies basically that the video was encrypted and he had no ability to decrypt that.
So you don't equate access with play?
Correct, Your Honor. So his 100% guarantee is dependent on those three factors, and the military judge did not acknowledge that. He just accepted the 100% guarantee as a finding of fact with no qualification, and that is why he abused his discretion with respect to that point.
So is this finding of fact clearly erroneous, unsupported by the record? What is your specific concern with it?
Yes, Your Honor, that it is clearly erroneous, because although he said he was 100% certain that he would have been able to access the phone, that certainty was limited by the additional qualifiers. And so to stop the sentence at 100% certainty is clearly erroneous, because there's limitations to that certainty that the military judge did not acknowledge.
Thank you.
Which brings me to the third factor that the government failed to prove with respect to whether or not Mr. TH or DC-3 as a whole would have inevitably accessed the Hide It Pro app. And this is with respect to paragraph 12 of the military judge's findings of fact. As discussed in appellant's assignment of error, for the inevitable discovery exception to apply, the government must prove that at the time of the illegal conduct, they possessed evidence or leads that would have led to the discovery of that evidence in a lawful manner. That means the government must prove that Mr. TH would have been able to access the Hide It Pro app on 10 September 2016, but he never testified as such. When he testified about accessing the Hide It Pro app, he was referring to the updated Cellebrite from 2017. And he never testified as to the capabilities of the Cellebrite from September of 2016. That's at page 78 of the record. To put it another way, Your Honors, He testified that as the date of his examination, which would have been October, November 2017, he was able to access the HIDED PRORAP. He did not testify that he was able to access it or would have been able to access it September 2016. The court can find this discussion as well on page 77 of the record, where he says to analyze Airman Painter's phone, he used, quote, the current version of Cellebrite, not the old version. Therefore, he was not able to access the HIDED Pro app the date that the illegal conduct occurred, and therefore it was abuse of discretion for the military judge to find otherwise. And finally, Your Honor, the government did not show that DC-3 would have inevitably been able to decrypt the video. So there are four layers to this. First, that they would have been able to send it to DC-3, that they would have. That they would have been able to access the phone, that they would have been able to access the HIDED Pro app, and now that they would have been able to decrypt the video. Mr. TH, as mentioned in answer to Judge Johnson's question, testified that the video file was encrypted and he had no capabilities of decrypting it. He had to use, the only way he was able to decrypt it was to use a PhD doctor cryptographer, and that's at page 86 and 87, to access the video. And this is critical because that cryptographer was not employed by DC-3 when this illegal conduct occurred.
Let me ask you about that. So is there evidence in the record as to whether there was a cryptographer on the staff at DC-3 in the September 2016 timeframe?
There is evidence in the record that they had a previous cryptographer, and that he later, at some point, he left and went to a university. There is no evidence as to whether or not he was there in that time frame or whether he left prior to that time frame.
Do we know when the cryptographer that actually decrypted the video was hired by DC-3?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And along that same line of thought, without this evidence, without this cryptographer, they would not have been able to have this original Python script that was able to break through and decrypt this video. He would not have done, page 87 of the record said, he did this open source cryptographic, I believe, libraries research. He wouldn't have been able to do that. So essentially, this original script was created only for Airman Painter's phone. It had never been created by anyone else before. And Senior Judge Mink, there is no evidence that the cryptographer was there at that time, but even if he was, there's no information as to his background, his education, whether he would have been able to do the same thing. And so therefore, the military judge abused his discretion when he found that the video would have been inevitably discovered. In conclusion, the inevitable discovery exception only applies when routine procedures would have inevitably led to the same evidence. Or stated differently, as this court did in Mancini, improperly obtained evidence is admissible if it inevitably would have been discovered through independent, lawful means. The four critical facts are already discussed that the government failed to prove is more than enough to state that the military judge abused his discretion. Each layer of this four-level analysis is rife with speculation and conjecture and statements about 100 and 1,000% certainties. The cold hard facts are Special Agent JJ lied to Airman Painter and told him he had to input his code because of the search authorization. She closed her investigation even when she didn't have the information she needed from BCMO. Charges were preferred, charges were referred, trial date was scheduled, she lied on the stand. There's no evidence that the appellant's phone wasn't updated to bypass Cellebrite. There's no evidence that Cellebrite was keeping up to date with the phone technologies. Mr. TH could access the HIDED Pro app using the updated Cellebrite, but there's no evidence that he could have done it with the later Cellebrite. The PhD cryptographer was not employed at DC-3 at the time. Those are the facts. Everything else is speculation and conjecture. And for that reason, we respectfully request that this court find that the military judge abused his discretion. Pending any further questions, that concludes my
presentation. Yeah, Major Miller, I've got a question. So I'd like to have you talk a little bit about if we find error, either because the photos and the video, or just the video, were not subject to inevitable discovery. What next? I'd like you to talk about harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, Your Honor. As mentioned in the appellant's brief, the government has the burden of showing that this error in whatever frame the court would decide was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which means that this court must be convinced that the error did not contribute to the verdict obtained. And that's what the court stated in Hunt in July 2019. Now, U.S. v. Condon, which is a CAF case, kind of in Moran as well, explains some of the factors for the court to consider, whether it's unimportant in relation to everything else the panel considered, was the effect dampened, like as a minor part, was other evidence properly admitted to support the convictions. Specifically turning to the convictions, there's three specifications and two charges. Two of the specifications involve the Article 120C, which would be the video recording and the taking of pictures of the private areas. And then the one involves the, the penetration offense. Without the photos in the video, there's no corroboration for Senior Airman CD's statement, that the appellant told him that that individual in the photos and the videos was A1CES. And even with Senior Airman CD's statements, he identified someone who had a tattoo in a location that A1CES didn't have. Without the photos and videos, she would not have been able to identify herself. Without the photos and videos, there's nothing for the 120C charge to even be based on. There's no proof anything happened because she stated that she does not remember what happened in that room that day. And the government understood the importance of the photos and the videos because every page of their findings PowerPoint slide literally talks about the cell phone evidence. Every single page talks about the cell phone, the photos, the videos. The government went so far as to say, and this is a quote, when you play the video, listen to what you hear. When you watch the video, watch it again with your eyes closed. Listen. You will hear the sound of snoring. You will hear the sound of snoring, the pattern of snoring, the up and down to the end of the video. Conscious people don't snore. Listen to the video carefully and critically. Close your eyes and listen. This was the government's entire findings argument. This was their case. And this error could not be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because it was so critical to the finding of guilty.
Did Senior Airman CD provide any testimony about A1CES being asleep at the time the photos and the video were taken?
He did not, Your Honor. There is Special Agent JJ mentioned that he told her that in the search authorization. Like in the initial search authorization, she wrote that in there. But when he testified, he said that the appellant did not say that.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Amicus counsel, on behalf of the appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Joseph Grossman, arguing along with my co-counsel, Andre Sapchwian, as amicus for the appellant, Airman Painter. The CAF has articulated that it is the duty of this court to safeguard the rights of service members in the military justice system. If this court finds for the government, it would not only condone a continuous and unabated Fifth Amendment violation, but it would also reward the government for that violation. We respectfully request that this court find the military judge erred in denying the motion to suppress. The record fails to prove that the contents of Airman Painter's phone were inevitably discoverable for two reasons. First, because Mr. Hoffecker's testimony is unlawfully obtained derivative evidence and cannot be used to prove inevitable discovery. Second, because the record fails to provide demonstrated historical facts that guarantee inevitability. So first, Mr. Hoffecker's testimony and findings are the product of a continuous Fifth Amendment violation and cannot be used to justify inevitable discovery. After hours of interrogation, Airman Painter invoked his right to an attorney. Subsequently, Agent Joseph, or Agent JJ, commanded him to enter the passcodes to his phone. In applying Mitchell, the military judge correctly found that the evidence obtained from Agent Joseph's manipulation was unlawful and violated the Fifth Amendment and the military rules of evidence. By that same rationale, the military judge should have concluded that Mr. Hoffecker's testimony and finding were similarly the result of an unlawful search of the phone. Like Agent Joseph's testimony, Mr. Hoffecker's testimony is the product of a continuous and unabated Fifth Amendment violation which lasted over a year. That violation was further exacerbated because when Mr. Hoffecker received the phone, not only were its passcodes disabled, but he also received the phone with a report attached to it in which Agent Joseph laid out everything that she had found from her manipulation of the phone. As long as the phone's security remained disabled, the Fifth Amendment violation persisted. OSI could have simply remedied their violation by re-enabling the password protections on the phone. However, they never did that. In Nix v. Williams, the Supreme Court held that the prosecution is not to be put in a better position than it would have been in if no illegality had occurred. However, the military judge's reliance on Mr. Hoffecker's testimony causes the prosecution to improperly benefit from their illegality. Therefore, his testimony cannot be used to justify inevitable discovery.
So let's go ahead, Mr. Grossman, and put the government back in the place they were when Airman Painter was asked to unlock his phone. You called it command. So if he never was asked that question, if there was never the Fifth Amendment violation, what would the normal procedures of the law enforcement agency have been?
Well, Your Honor, as Senior Judge Mink asked Major Miller, if there was evidence that the process in which the phone was sent for analysis was routine, Major Miller correctly answered that no, the record is void of such evidence. What the record does show is Agent Joseph saying that she was certain she would have sent the phone to DCFL. However, her certainty relies on a number of assumptions which would violate the conjecture and speculation that this court must not engage in when analyzing inevitability. As Major Miller noted, it is not Agent Joseph's decision of where to send the phone. In fact, in the case at bar, Agent Joseph did want to initially send the phone to DCFL. However, her superintendent insisted that it be sent to Bossier City for analysis. In addition, in cross-examination, Agent Joseph conceded that it is not necessarily the practice of her office to send phones to DCFL after BCMO for analysis. Furthermore, what makes the process that the phone followed anything but routine is the fact that Bossier City and Peden's digital forensic analysis both tried twice and both failed twice to access the video. They failed to access the video even with the phone's passcodes disabled and with the clues from Agent Joseph of how she had found the phone. Another thing I wanted to highlight was that the record discloses no evidence that for the purposes of an inevitable discovery analysis, the legal office prosecuting the case is considered a law enforcement agency. And Senior Judge Mink, I see my time is up. May I briefly conclude?
Please.
In fact, in the Manual for Courts Martial, there are several sections and even definitional sections which list the legal office, trial counsel, and judge advocates as separate entities from a law enforcement agency. The record fails to show that it was routine for the legal office to check out evidence and send it for further analysis after OSI had concluded its investigation. If this court finds for the government, it would condone the continuous violation of a service member's Fifth Amendment rights and then allow the government to benefit from that violation. For the foregoing reasons, we respectfully request that this court find for the appellant because the contents of Airman Painter's phone were not inevitably discoverable. Thank you.
Mr. Grossman, is there any evidence in the record that if the phone had been locked and not unlocked by Airman Painter at direction of the OSI, that the phone would have still gone to the Bossier City Marshal's office? In other words, it was unlocked and that's where it was sent, but is there any evidence in the record that it would not have been sent there and would have been sent to DCFL or DC3?
Your Honor, the only evidence in the record to suggest that is that Agent Joseph initially wanted the phone to be sent to DCFL. However, as I stated, that was not her decision to make. And in September of 2016, at the time of Airman Painter's interrogation, DCFL was experiencing a 4 to 6 month backlog. So even if they had decided to send the phone straight there, it's unclear that DCFL would have been able to accept the case.
Okay. Thank you. Government counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. City Council, Judge Link, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Kelsey Schuss, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Brian Mason, I represent the United States. This court should find the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he determined the digital evidence of a sexual assault, including explicit photos and video, would be found and were admissible. The military judge's ruling was correct because the record proves the strong chain of inevitable discovery linking a lawful search warrant for appellant's phone to the cyber crime lab accessing the phone to recovery of the digital evidence of the sexual assault. I'd like to address three main reasons why the government prevails in this case. First, the detailed eyewitness report. The government knew appellant's phone contained digital evidence of a sexual assault from the very beginning because they had an eyewitness who saw it firsthand. Second, accessing the phone. If the phone had remained locked, the record proves the cybercrime lab, or DC3, would have had the tools to access it. And third, the cybercrime lab's procedures. Once inside the phone, testimony about routine procedures at DC3 showed the evidence would be recovered. All of these reasons support the military judge's ruling that no rights violation had occurred and the phone remained locked, that the government would have inevitably discovered the digital evidence of the sexual assault. The first reason the government prevails in this case is because of the detailed eyewitness report. Senior Airman CD's report to law enforcement from the very beginning described very vividly photos and videos that he saw firsthand to be on appellant's phone. This was information that law enforcement used to get a lawful search warrant so that they could then search all of the contents of appellant's phone, to include specifically any storage applications. That is a listed category that they wanted to search within the warrant that was authorized. This information is important because it explains why the government would have continued to look for this evidence, and it also corroborates Agent JJ's testimony when she says that they would not have stopped seeking for this evidence because they needed access to that testimony. To that phone, and that's on the record at page 27. So although the appellant wants this analysis to start in the OSI detachment room after the rights violation, this inevitable discovery analysis really begins after appellant sexually assaulted Airman First Class ES, because the government was already on notice of all of the evidence that they needed to know that they needed to pursue what was in this phone. It's this information that the government agents possessed before the illegality occurred. It's important to note what happened after the illegality is not necessarily part of an inevitable discovery doctrine. There's an important distinction between what happened to what would have happened. And that is a problem that the appellant runs into in conflating an inevitable discovery analysis. Here, we know everything I've mentioned about Airman CD's report and the lawful warrant that was authorized all happened prior to any illegality in this case. This information is relevant. It's important for this court to consider because the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces in Owens talks about what agents would do with information they already have. In particular, in Owens, the court looked at what information the law enforcement agents had available to them and determining what routine procedures they would have followed. Similarly, in this case, like in Owens, we had a backdrop that informed what the agents would have done with the information if they could not have accessed the appellant's phone. And there is no reasonable likelihood that the government agents in this case would have at any point abandoned their efforts. They had reason to believe not only that appellant sexually assaulted Airman First Class ES, they had reason to believe there was digital evidence documenting this crime.
Captain Schuster, let me ask you, because you said there was no reason to believe that they would have abandoned their efforts, but at least with respect to the video, they concluded their report prior to being able to access the video, correct?
That's accurate, yes, sir.
So they had stopped their efforts to access the video at that point, had they not?
Your Honor, when the device eventually made its way to DC3, Mr. TH testified that he did have to stop and produce a preliminary report for production, but he did not give up accessing the video.
I understand, but I'm actually talking about prior to that when the OSI closed out their investigation. I believe it was the last couple of months of 2016, because the phone wasn't sent to DCFL until sometime late 2017, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so what I was getting at was is when the Bossier City Marshal's Office was not able to access the video, the OSI did not continue looking for our access to get access to the video. Am I correct on that?
Your Honor, OSI already had a copy of the video in its possession because the local agents were able to backdoor away into the device to get the video.
Right, but that was in violation of his rights to counsel, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The point here that's important to note is that appellant tries to undercut Agent JJ's credibility in stating that there's no reason to believe what she says and what would have happened with the evidence subsequent to the alleged rights violation. But the attack on Agent JJ's credibility is unconvincing because the military judge and his reliance on her is not clearly erroneous. When we look at the attack on Agent JJ's credibility, we know that the military judge had all of the evidence before him that the appellant relies on now. And to be specific, he watched the same video that the appellant cites to and did not find the same or draw the same conclusion that the appellant makes. He concluded, consistent with Agent JJ's testimony, that she did not see the passcode that the appellant used to unlock his cell phone. And that's in the military judge's finding of fact. So although he didn't adopt her testimony in full, he did adopt that portion of her testimony and found that to be credible. And he didn't make a verbatim credibility determination to say that it was credible, but he continued to rely on her testimony, which shows that he deemed her to be credible. And in that courtroom, Your Honors, it's important to remember that the military judge did have an ability to see and hear Agent JJ testify, and also to consider whether any of her inconsistencies were innocent mistakes or deliberate lies. So although the appellant may disagree with what the military judge ultimately found, the standard of review here, the strict abuse of discretion standard of review, calls for more than just a difference of opinion. The video does not disprove the military judge's finding or make it clearly erroneous in any way. So when this court is applying the standard in this case, and looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, which is the government, This court should also rely on Agent J.J.'s testimony because it was uncontradicted and not clearly erroneous.
Okay, just let's talk about the phone being locked. The military judge's finding that if the phone was locked and BCMO was unable to bypass the security code. The military judge adopted that finding of fact, which seems to me to show that the phone is going to BCMO before it goes to DC-3. So what are the capabilities of BCMO? Were they able to bypass the security features?
Your Honor, the record is not developed as it relates to BCMO's capability to bypass the security feature. We don't know what BCMO necessarily would have done, but we do know that if there would have been a problem, it was the routine procedure of this OSI detachment to send things to DC-3 as a stopgap. So Agent JJ testified that it's her normal practice to send things to DC-3. And if they use another agency, but they're unable to access the information, then DC-3 would always be their stopgap. And this relates back, sir, Your Honor, to your question when you were asking about if the phone itself would have not been able to be accessed, or if that meant the entirety of the evidence that the phone contained. And the record on page 27 has an important distinction here, because Agent JJ testified that if the phone was sent to the local law enforcement agency and they were unable to access everything on the phone, then they would have just sent it to DC-3 and waited. So even assuming that BCMO had the capability to access the phone and bypass the lock, if they didn't similarly have the capacity and ability to access the photos and the video, there is no reason to believe that the law enforcement and the government agencies involved would have just abandoned their efforts to find the photos and the video that they knew existed on the appellant's phone.
So, Captain Schuss, you keep saying access. Is access people view? Is there anywhere in the record that it says they would have been able to view it?
Your Honor, there is nowhere in the record that says that that's what the agents meant. But when they're looking at access to the phone, that inherently means that they needed to have an ability to view the video in and of itself. They had access to the phone because they needed to be able to unlock it. But then you can't necessarily have access to a video by simply viewing the first frame of the video. They need also to be able to see the video in order to access it and assess its full criminality.
Didn't the senior trial counsel argue to the military judge that it didn't matter when the video was actually decrypted so it could be played, and that he could do that in the middle of trial and it wouldn't matter at all to inevitability?
Your Honor, he may have argued that that didn't matter for inevitability, but my understanding of the question is what they needed to be able to do to access the video, specifically with regard to BCMO's capacities. So if BCMO could identify the video, presumably at some point for trial counsel to play it, they needed to be able to also access and be able to play the video.
So is that because the video, you could see the first screenshot of it and determine what it was even without playing it?
Yes, Your Honor. The video, according to Mr. TH's testimony, when he first found it, he could be able to see where it was, when it got there, how it was originally played, and when it had been encrypted by appellant, just from seeing the video itself. But he could only play the video after he had the encryption. So that would be the important distinction there. They knew that it was there and they knew what it was. They just needed the ability to play it. And that, Your Honors, turns to my second point, and the second reason the government prevails in this case, which is because of access to appellant's phone. The record supports the military judge's finding that the phone would have been unlocked. This was the essential fact number one from appellant's counsel, and the government disagrees because the record supports that if the phone was locked, it would have gotten to DC-3 eventually in some way, because the government would not have stopped working to access that phone until they had the full contents of the phone, according to Senior Airman CD's statement that it contained both explicit photos and video. Access to the phone was a fairly simple task, according to Mr. TH's testimony. He described that it didn't necessarily require any special skills to use the Cellebrite program and be able to apply that to bypass the lock. He also testified, in his expert opinion, he was 100% certain that that phone would have been unlocked. Trial defense counsel even conceded this point at trial when they said it's very likely that they would have broken into that phone based on the make and model of the phone and the vulnerabilities it had at the time. And Your Honors, that record site is at page 121. This is an important distinction in this case between the court case here and also in the United States versus Hunt, where in that case, there was no evidence to support that the phone could have been unlocked. And so the military judge abused his discretion in making that determination. Here, the record shows, and trial defense counsel even conceded, the phone would have been unlocked. Turning to the third reason the government prevails in this case, the record supports the military judge's finding that DC-3 would have been able to access the contents of appellant's cell phone. The concept of routine procedures here doesn't require the government agents to account for every possible contingency that they would have ran into. And it doesn't require the government to strictly adhere to some sort of investigative checklist. It only requires that a routine practice existed and reasonably and inevitably lead to the discovery of the evidence in a lawful manner. And I point the court to a quotation from United States versus Epps, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces decision from 2018, where the court described that the inevitable discovery exception unavoidably requires acceptance of certain reasonable assumptions. This is an important distinction from what appellant argued, because reasonable supported assumptions are different from the conjecture or the speculation that the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces and Maxwell warns of.
What was the routine procedure for this OSI detachment in getting the information from a cell phone? Was it to send it to DCFL, or was it to send it to the BCMO?
Your Honor, there's not a clear answer in the record about what they would have done on a regular basis. It seems to have depended on what DC-3's capacity was at the time and what evidence they already had in their possession. And I'm drawing that inference, Your Honor, from Agent JJ's testimony, where she says she sent it to the local law enforcement agency primarily because of the backlog at DC-3, and also because she was looking for confirmation data, information about metadata. They already had the evidence in their possession, although from the unlawful search, it was not unlawful at the time that the decision was made about where to send the evidence.
But also, that was at the direction of the superintendent for the detachment, correct, to send it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The detachment, although they might have made decisions based on what evidence they had at the time and what their capacities and timelines were, the record does show that if they ever ran into a problem, the stopgap that they used to access evidence that they needed to access was DC-3 and sending evidence to DC-3. So when we look at the specific procedures that DC-3 used, we start with the conclusion that the diligence that they use and the agents at DC-3 use is not just limited to one particular agent, as appellant has argued, because the agents work in a collaborative environment. There's no reason to conclude that this evidence was discovered just because of Mr. TH's involvement, when the record shows that they work together and do not stop if they run into problems. And in particular, the record at page 96 shows that the examiners consult with each other every day about issues. It's common for them to talk with each other and share information, in particular if they don't have expertise in an area. For example, Mr. TH was prior law enforcement, but he testified that they also have computer engineers there. They use each other's experience, and he testified that they don't stop evaluating just because they run into a roadblock. They work to find the solution.
So I'll go back to Senior Judge Mink's question of appellate counsel. What evidence is there in the record that they had a cryptologist at the time the illegality occurred at DC3?
Your Honor, there is no evidence that that position was currently filled at the time of the alleged illegality. However, the fact that they had that billet shows that DC3 knew that they would need specialized expertise to be able to access evidence. In this case, the fact that they did not have someone on staff at that particular time is not dispositive, because it's more important that law enforcement knew what they would have needed to do to access the evidence. An example of this is something I previously mentioned. Mr. TH actually initially closed his report without accessing the video. But that doesn't mean that he gave up or that DC3 gave up trying to get that evidence, because they knew that it would be important for this case.
Is it that it's important for this case, or is it that it's a normal law enforcement procedure that would inevitably have happened?
Your Honor, I believe that those two questions rely on the same set of facts, because as this court noted in Owens, or the point that the court makes in Owens, the knowledge that agents have is going to dictate the procedures and the routine procedures that they use. And it would be unreasonable to conclude that they would simply abandon their efforts to access that information, given all of the other information that they had prior to the alleged illegality.
So the fact that the government was ready to go to trial in October without DC3 on their witness list, how do you respond to that?
Your Honor, at that time in October, the trial counsel and the government, frankly, was working to try as much as they could comply with the evolving legal landscape that was happening. If we are applying inevitable discovery, in this case, we have to assume that there was no alleged illegality and that the phone remained locked. If we make that assumption, then there is no need to assume that the government is operating against some artificial trial date and that they have a limited window of time to be able to access the evidence. Because there's nothing to show us that the government would have closed their investigation or frankly even preferred charges if they didn't have access to this evidence, because they knew that it was there from Senior Airman CD's statement. And turning to what appellant cites as their essential fact number 3 and whether the photos could have been accessed, the record here supports the military judge's finding and is clearly supported, because the information shows that agents knew at DC3 to look in these applications, to look in these storage applications. And the agent testified that they commonly deal with people who try to hide things. So they know to look in the type of file vault applications where Mr. TH eventually found the photos here. He was able to review and find the photos not just by looking at the 35,000 videos that were on appellant's phone. He had the date, the 3 August date, that is information he would have had available to him regardless of whether the illegality occurred or not, and would have significantly narrowed the review. Entering to accessing the video, which was the appellant's essential fact number 4, the record also supports the military judge's conclusion that this would have been accessed as well. Based on Mr. TH's testimony, he found the video. He saw that it was there. He knew that it was there, how it got there, when it had been played, and when it had been encrypted. All he needed was to be able to decrypt it. The local agents could do this themselves in the field, Obviously, that would be potentially the result of a rights violation, but it's persuasive information that the local agents themselves could have an ability to access that file and make a recording of it. And here, they had to use a cryptologist, but it's reasonable to conclude that even if one was not on staff, they would have just waited because the government knew that this evidence was there and wanted to access this evidence from Senior Airman CD's report.
Counsel, I want to go back to one point you just made. Weren't the agents able to access the video and play the video because they had the passcode due to the rights violation?
Your Honor, there's not evidence on the record that the passcode had any relationship to the encryption that was used to unlock the video that I'm aware of. It seems that the video encryption was a particular encryption method specific to the LG device that was there, and the testimony that the agent provided, that the court military judge at the time endorsed, is that she never actually had the passcode provided to her. It was just unlocked. So even though that information, Mr. TH testified, was available to him about what Agent JJ did, he also testified that he would have done the same analysis himself anyway. The information that was provided in the DC-3 search authorization didn't change or aid or hinder his investigation or his analysis in any way because he followed what were DC-3's routine procedures to both find and access and play, to the extent that access and play mean something different, the photos and the video in this case.
Does the fact that a year transpired between the BCMO review of the phone and DC-3's review, does that play in at all to our analysis of this under inevitable discovery?
No, Your Honor. The fact that that time passed is nothing more than the result of a couple different things. There were two continuances in this case that were driven by the defense, which if they were not made might have changed the government's approach. But also, the government believed that they had access and a lawful way to admit this evidence shortly after the crime happened and didn't actually start trying to find alternate means or realize that maybe they had violated the law until around the time of United States versus Mitchell, the spring of 2017.
Can you address harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt if we find error?
Yes, Your Honor. Harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt requires the government to prove that any error did not contribute to the verdict in this case. And in this case, because of the strength of the video and the photos, it is a tough call. But it's important for this court to remember that the government admitted evidence of more than just the photos and videos. They had an eyewitness who saw the photos and the video and whom the appellant told the photos were taken of Airman Enos and had been taken at a party around the time of the 3rd of August. So this is not a scenario, as appellant suggested, where that report would be totally uncorroborated and therefore somehow inadmissible. The government had evidence about the fact that they had been at a party. The government had evidence that they had fallen asleep or presumably were going to sleep together on the couch from another witness. The government had enough to put them together. And then for Airman CD to say that he saw this evidence, and then for similarly, Airman ES to say that something happened. So this is not a case where the only evidence, if this court finds error, that the government relied on, would be suppressed. And the government would put on evidence from the witness saying he saw one, Pending any further questions from this court, I'd like to briefly conclude. When an eyewitness reports seeing digital evidence of a sexual assault on someone's cell phone, there is no reasonable likelihood that law enforcement would simply abandon their efforts to access it. The military judge's findings of fact are supported by the record, and his conclusions of law are accurate. He did not abuse his discretion in denying the defense motion to suppress the explicit photos and the video that the appellant captured while Airman First Class ES slept. This court should affirm appellant's convictions and sentence for sexual assault and indecent recording. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Schmitz. Amicus counsel, on behalf of the government, you may proceed.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Alice Lee, and my partner Cesar Bernstein and I are arguing as amicus on behalf of the appellee. We respectfully request this court to affirm the military judge's decision in denying the motion to suppress evidence from appellant's phone because he properly applied the inevitable discovery exception. There are two main points that I would like to make today. First, the government was actively pursuing an investigation pursuant to a valid search authorization. And second, the routine procedures would have led to the inevitable discovery of the contents of appellant's phone. The government has met its burden by preponderance of evidence in demonstrating these elements of inevitable discovery pursuant to federal jurisprudence. And therefore, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding so. First, the government was actively pursuing an investigation at the time of the violation. And the government has demonstrated this by acting pursuant to a valid search authorization at the time the agents requested appellant unlock his phone. The government also only needs to show that this evidence was pursued in any or some fashion, and there is no legal requirement that it be a neat trail devoid of deviations or delays. The appellant argues that because the phone went to multiple locations over an extended period of time, there was no active pursuit, or that these were, in fact, subsequent violations. However, this is not relevant to the analysis of inevitable discovery, because at the time of the violation, the government demonstrated they were seeking the evidence in some fashion by acting pursuant to the search authorization. United States v. Wallace should be persuasive here. The Court of Appeals of Armed Forces found that inevitable discovery applied when the government was acting pursuant to only probable cause when they were searching the appellant's laptop. Probable cause was sufficient for active pursuit of an investigation because they would have inevitably gotten search authorization. The facts here are even more favorable for the government. They had probable cause from statements of a witness who had firsthand account of the evidence on the appellant's phone, and they had subsequent valid authorization to search this phone. And this should more than suffice for this doctrine to apply. And with this evidence viewed in light most favorable to the government, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding that the government was in active pursuit of the investigation. Second, if routine procedures were followed, evidence on appellant's phone would have inevitably been discovered. And the government has demonstrated this by a preponderance of evidence through Agent JJ and Mr. TH's testimony at trial about what routine procedures would have been followed and how they could have inevitably accessed the contents of appellant's phone. The appellant relies on United States v. Mitchell and asks the court to guarantee that the actual procedures followed was routine. However, Mitchell is factually distinguishable because the government failed to argue that a forensic examiner could have bypassed the security on the phone. And as a result, it was clearly speculation about what routine procedures would have been followed for a Touch ID access that they weren't aware of at that time. And furthermore, the legal standard for routine procedures is in fact lower than what the appellant argues. We're focusing on if routine procedures were followed, would the evidence have inevitably been discovered? And the answer there is yes. There's testimony from Agent JJ and Mr. TH that it would have been routine protocol to send the evidence to DC-3 had the phone been locked when they got access to the phone. When they seized his phone pursuant to the search authorization. And there's no speculation about what would have been done had the illegality not occurred. Mr. TH specifically testified that there are three ways to access the phone if it came to DC-3 unlocked, that numerous other agents at DC-3 would have been able to do as well. As Appellate Government Counsel noted, Mr. TH also testified that they normally deal with people who are hiding pictures in their phone using apps like the appellant here. Wallace should also be persuasive here because the Court of Appeals of Armed Forces found that investigator testimony that routine procedures would have obtained evidence was sufficient. And here we have that testimony as well. In conclusion, the appellant here is arguing for evidence to be viewed in light least favorable to the government. However, this court should be viewing it most favorable to the government. Given the evidence in this particular case, the government has clearly demonstrated its burden by preponderance of evidence that inevitable discovery applies. And therefore, this court should find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion and that the government should prevail.
Question.
Yes, can you address the, if, let's assume we do find error, can you address the harmlessness?
Yes, Your Honor. So as appellate government counsel had mentioned that it would be tough because here we have such corroborating evidence of appellant's guilt here. However, under the doctrine for looking at harmless error for a constitutional violation, we're looking at if there's evidence in the record independent of the evidence obtained here. And there's Senior Airman CD's report and testimony of what he saw on the phone firsthand and what appellant had told him of his wrongdoing. Appellate defense counsel argues that Senior Airman CD's testimony is uncorroborated. However, the appellant does not point to any legal requirement for corroborating for eyewitness testimony. And here, this testimony from Senior Airman CD and Airman First Class ES's report and testimony should more than suffice for finding a guilty of appellant.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Appellant's counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to start with the harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. As the appellee stated, they have an eyewitness to the video. But this eyewitness to the video identified a tattoo that wasn't present on A1C ES. Also, they have a alleged victim who doesn't remember anything. They have Senior Airman MA who did not witness anything and she was there present. That is what the government's case is, without the photos and without the videos. That does not meet the harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Didn't Airman Painter tell Airman CD who that was in the video?
Your Honor, Judge Johnson, that's what we're referring to when we talk about the corroborating statement.
Okay.
That is the statement that needs corroboration. And without the photos and the videos, there is none. Now, Senior Judge Mink, I believe you asked the appellee's counsel, a year passed, does that matter or not? And it definitely matters. There are technology changes that are being made quite frequently over a year's time. There's too much speculation in what technology would have developed, what technology wouldn't have developed. Also, in considering the CAF's decision in Mitchell at page 420, this is what CAF said with respect to the government's future actions and future knowledge. The government did not even learn about the fingerprints until 15 months after the offending conduct. So it does matter that the fact that this was a year later when they were actually able to access this information. Your Honor, there were several times when appellee's counsel mentioned it's not clearly indicated in the record. It's not clear on the record. They have the burden of affirmatively establishing by a preponderance of the evidence these facts. When the record is not clear and there's no indication on the record, that is their burden. That is something that they failed to prove. And therefore, it is the military judge abuses discretion in finding those facts. And with respect to the routineness of the procedures, appellee's counsel said, we know that it would have gotten to DC-3 in some way, at some point. Again, Your Honors, that is speculation. Appellee's counsel can't even tell you how it would have gotten there. They can't tell you the procedures. They can't tell you when they would have sent it. And actually, BCMO had the same capabilities as DC-3. There is nothing in the record, which is their burden to prove, that they would have continued this beyond BCMO. If BCMO said we can't access it, either it was deleted or they would just assume that they can't get to it. We know this because Special Agent JJ said she needed metadata. She needed dates, she needed times, she needed names of the files. And when BCMO could not give her that, what did she do? She closed the case. And Senior Judge Mink, I think you highlighted that. She closed the case without that information. And the government referred, set a trial date. They did all of that. They were going to proceed without information that they needed. So there is evidence in the record that had they not been able to access, the BCMO had not been able to access this information, they would have just stopped. And Your Honors, just to conclude briefly, probable cause in a search authorization is not the end of this inquiry. There's steps to be taken. With that search authorization, they would not have had access to his phone. They would not have had access to the Hide It Pro app. They would not have had access to the video, and they would not have been able to decrypt it with just that paper. The analysis goes beyond that, and that's what's important in this case. Pending any questions, please remember.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you all for your arguments, and thank you to GW Law for hosting us. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed. Please remain seated. And I believe we're going to have a question and answer period.